everybody, and welcome to the Damage Report on what might be a historic day. I hear someone's getting impeached. Stick around to find out who. No, I'm Johnny DeRola. J.R. Jackson's also in the studio.
You know, we said it last week, man. Things happen on Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm. They do.
They happen on Wednesdays.
They do. At least, if you look back through the entirety of American history, at least one out of three impeachments on a Wednesday.
They signed the Declaration.
Which is disproportionate.
It's
not
crazy.
Not a lot of Sunday impeachments.
They signed the Declaration of Independence on a Wednesday, on a JR.
Did they really?
Because they knew that I was going to be hosting that day.
Hmm. Okay. Well, look, we've got a lot that we're going to be talking about today. We're going to get to general commentary on the impeachment, which is literally going on right now, actually. We're missing it because of you people. So we are going to talk about that. But we've also got Pete Buttigieg's donors, more information coming out. We've got updates on the Democrat who is considering flipping parties to support Donald Trump. Very interesting behind the scenes information about what he actually thinks about Donald Trump. And Lisa Page, who's been talked about a lot over the past few years, finally does a media appearance. She was on Rachel Maddow last night, so we will be talking about that appearance as well. But first, the letter. Yesterday, Donald Trump, he wrote a letter all by himself, and he sent it to Nancy Pelosi, and it was something. If you don't like Donald Trump, wow. If you do like Donald Trump, wow, it must have been great for you. And look, we can't read the entire thing because it is the longest thing in many years that has been attributed to Donald Trump, whether he wrote it or not. But we're gonna read at least a little bit to give you an idea of what he is thinking about impeachment and how he wants the media to cover it, how he wants the people to respond to it. So he starts off saying, "Dear Madam Speaker, I write to express my strongest and most powerful protest against the partisan impeachment crusade being pursued by the Democrats in the House of Representatives. This impeachment represents an unprecedented and unconstitutional abuse of power by Democrat lawmakers, unequaled in nearly 2.5 centuries of American legislative history." Well, as we've pointed out, it is equal because two other people have been impeached. Also, it's not unconstitutional when it's literally in the Constitution.
It's
almost nothing is constitutional. Way more things aren't in the Constitution than are, but this is actually.
Have you noticed that things are unprecedented, both good and bad, when it comes to this guy?
Unprecedented and never been heard before.
Yeah, it's never been heard before, it's never been done to this scale, to this degree, ever in American history. No matter what, whether it's a good thing where he says, "Yeah, never been so many people have voted for me," which we're going to get to in this letter. No, not many people have voted for me, have been in an inauguration, have been in rallies. And then on the flip side, never in American history has this many people been so against me, have been the media's acted this way, have they conducted such a witch hunt, has this been this partisan. All these things are so unprecedented.
Yeah.
Before it's all said and done, Donald Trump is going to declare himself the first president in American history somehow.
Yeah.
He's already compared himself to George Washington.
Yeah, the thing where everything is unprecedented and everything hasn't been heard before either means that he is just the most hyperbolic person in history, or he's like effectively a goldfish. Every 30 seconds, he forgets everything he knows. And so I've never heard this before. But anyway, also note that he said, "My strongest and most powerful protest. I generally am of the opinion, don't call things you're doing powerful." So this is effectively like the same as like a kid who doesn't want to like go to bed at night. He's lodging a protest. If he begins crying and stamping his feet, that's his most powerful protest. And you'll get what I mean as we read more of this letter. So he goes on to say, "The articles of impeachment introduced by the House Judiciary Committee are not recognizable under any standard of constitutional theory, interpretation, or jurisprudence. They include no crimes, no misdemeanors, and no offenses whatsoever. You have cheapened the importance of the very ugly word, impeachment." That's such a weird little tick at the end. The very ugly word, impeachment.
It's an important but very ugly word. Under what terms are you supposed to use it? Like, you cheapen it by using a very ugly but important word. So what circumstance do you use an ugly but important word?
I don't know. It's like the letter could be a lot more concise. and I'm sure, like, it's been edited clearly, unless you think that he came up with the word jurisprudence on his own. But still quite lengthy. But look, let's get to the meat of it, which is both some really obvious lies, but also his attempt to explain his behavior during the entire scandal. He says, "Everyone, you included, knows what is really happening. Your chosen candidate lost the election in 2016 in an electoral college landslide, 306 to 227. We'll return to that in just 1 second. And you and your party have never recovered from this defeat. You have developed a full-fledged case of what many in the media call Trump derangement syndrome, and sadly, you will never get over it. You are unwilling and unable to accept the verdict issued at the ballot box during the great capital E election of 2016. So you've spent 3 straight years attempting to overturn the will of the American people and nullify their votes. You view democracy as your enemy. There's a lot there. Really fast, he said 306 to 227. Just want to be clear, the final result, you can find out yourself. It's 304 to 227. Now look, I know that that might seem petty to point out that he gave himself a bigger buffer than he actually had. But I would not have done it, I swear, if he hasn't repeated that lie literally 100 or more times since he was elected. He keeps saying 306. It's not true, it's just not. And also, it's a landslide. It's like the 47th biggest lead that someone has had in the Electoral College. We've only had like 50 odd elections. And so that's weird too. But anyway, let's return to the substance there, where he's complaining about Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah.
This is an official letter from the president on the eve of impeachment, claiming that they just hate him and they've gone mad with hatred.
I'm curious which part of the media this coined it. Trump derangement syndrome, because I thought, because there's this guy in the White House that keeps saying the media is corrupt, it's fake, and they're always against him. Which part of the media is the one that's calling it Trump derangement syndrome if the media Fox. Is the one that's against you all the time? Just say it.
Fox.
Right? Yeah, just say it openly. It was a part of the end of that. I'm sorry. So the 306, we're talking about the how much he's won by. So let's compare it to how much he's going after Adam Schiff, who he says apparently should be executed. Off of paraphrasing what he said on the phone call with Ukraine, that lie, that outrageous lie that Adam Schiff said, because he paraphrased your words to make sure people know what happened, is devastating to your presidency and to the truth.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to overlook the fact that you keep changing the Electoral College numbers on your victory. No, this is a big
deal. Over and over.
Yeah, if you do it constantly, you have a problem with people that
it's just weird.
That
it's so
point
funny.
Out things about you that you consider lies that are actually the truth. And yet you can change the numbers on something that's as definite and determined.
Yeah.
As the numbers of an election.
Yeah, and by the way, the projection in you view democracy as your enemy, they're disenfranchising voters literally everywhere across the country right now. There is nothing they hate more than the ability of people to vote freely and to choose their own leaders. Also, just a historical note, the origin of blank derangement syndrome, do you wanna know where that came from? So as far as I have been able to find out, the first derangement syndrome was Bush derangement syndrome, and it was a term that was applied to critics of George W. Bush, who were opposed to him, and they were cast as crazies. You just don't like Bush because you don't like his war, which you're totally wrong about. It's gonna be so awesome. You're just driven by hatred for George W. Bush. Those people were proven 100 times over to be right about that conflict and how horrendously wasteful and damaging and tragic it was. And so, yes, cast me as having Trump derangement syndrome. That only implies to me that in the future, people will look back and think that we were those who actually had our eyes open while this was going on.
It's way worse.
Okay, let's move on to a little bit more of the letter. He goes on to say, once I presented the transcribed call, wasn't a transcript, but which surprised and shocked the fraudsters. They never thought that such evidence would be presented. Let's pause there, because I agree with him. But not for the reason that he says it. I didn't think that you would present it because it was damning evidence of the scheme that you were cooking up.
Absolutely.
Anyway, continuing, the so-called whistleblower, it's not so-called, like you don't like him, I get it, but he is a whistleblower. Anyway, and the second whistleblower disappeared because they got caught. Their report was a fraud and they were no longer going to be made available to us. In other words, once the phone call is made public, your whole plot blew up, but that didn't stop you from continuing. I mean, look, I get that that's what he wants to have happened, but the scandal was not that bad for him until the transcript was released. That exploded it. Nancy Pelosi was not pushing for impeachment
Absolutely.
Before the transcript. So that is a really weird rewriting of history.
She kind of wasn't pushing for it afterwards. One of the things that she and even at one point, I think Adam Schiff were catching hell from many liberals was they're not going after impeachment, even on things before this. So there's not much of a leg to stand on in saying that from the beginning, these Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, has been hell-bent on impeachment. No, she hasn't. She was getting raked over the coals over not pursuing impeachment.
Yeah.
So we can't forget the facts of how this all went down. And number two, again, like you said, it wasn't really a transcript, but definitely the surprising part was that they even put that in there.
Yeah.
Consistently over and over again, but talk about it. There was a Daily Show part where they asked supporters, did you read the transcript? No, they didn't. And he knows that they won't.
Exactly. So one of the lines that's getting the most press out of this is more due process was afforded to those accused in the Salem witch trials. I looked into it. No. So again, and it's not just factually inaccurate and a weird thing. I know he's obsessed with the witch hunt thing and everything. But it's also that, like, the impeachment inquiry is not a trial. It's not a criminal trial. Even the Senate trial is not a criminal trial. It is to say that, like, your regular constitutional, like, rights are being infringed. That's just not the case. You are being treated in the same way that Bill Clinton was, and that, you know, in a couple years when they're trying to impeach Bernie Sanders, the same exact way. It has nothing to do with due process. But he goes on to say one last thing. This is the end. Mercifully, 100 years from now, when people look back at this affair, I want them to understand it and learn from it so that it can never happen to another president again. Sincerely yours, it's an 8 on the Richter scale. And I agree. I do agree. I hope that in 100 years, people are still looking back on this and learning from it. I hope not to not do it to another president or whatever, but that I hope people can look back and say, that was a dark time for our country, that we chose an idiotic buffoon of a demagogue like Donald Trump. And I hope that we can look back, and I hope they all laugh at us, honestly. I hope that they've moved on so far that they will just wonder, what were they thinking then? And I say to you, my future descendants, if I'm lucky enough to have them, I agree. I don't know what we were thinking.
many of us were not. But also, again, the approach he took in talking about how this is unprecedented and it's hurt me and I can't believe you guys would do this to America. This is the ravings of a person who's never been held responsible for any of their actions in their life. So when someone says, hey, you can't do that, and he goes, of course I can, because he has said that. Mm. Of course I can do that. I'm me. And then someone actually pushes back. He goes, how dare you? I'm Donald J. Trump. I can do whatever I want. This is the guy who's never been held responsible. When a 5-year-old is not given the consequences to his actions, he's going to keep doing them. And then when you're 77 years old and you haven't been held responsible, you're going to go, why are you starting now?
Yeah. Yeah. Look how the spoiled kids in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory responded when they were finally held accountable by that brave entrepreneur.
And he had to know this letter would go public. It's not like this is a private letter.
No, it's 100. This is for his base.
The
They'll
whole point
love
is
this.
For them to hear him yell in a letter form rather than on Twitter.
There's nothing more that they want than a president who could be bouncing off the walls of an insane asylum, basically. And they will love this. I get that. But I have higher expectations of other people. So that's where we turn to this next section. Donald Trump sent out his letter. It's insane. We have another video on the channel. You can read it, but you can also read the full letter because we only read like 6% of it. It's crazy, full of lies, language below, but beneath the dignity of the office. He talks about capital A, angry capital D lawyer. I don't know, whatever. It's all of his conspiracy theories all condensed into one little spark notes, basically. And so, fine, he's going to send it. He can do that. He's the president, but I expect the media to be honest about what it is, what's in it, and what it represents. But they didn't do that. And so, look, you could find any number of examples of this. I'm just gonna run through a couple of quick ones. So this is just the way that social media works now. Politico tweeted, quote, more due process was afforded to those accused in the Salem witch trials, President Trump wrote to Pelosi. That's not true. You could mention that. There's room. That's not 280 characters. And the thing at the bottom says Trump savages impeachment. Like, you're trying to make him seem cool and powerful. These were the insane ramblings of a madman, full of lies. And if I just followed you for news and I was like, I just want to stay up on what's going on in the country, you failed me. You failed me on one of the most important things going on this year.
No, but the thing, there's the cover. You're going to get to more of these headlines. Yeah. Their cover is that, no, that is what happened. You know, more due process was afforded to these accused than those accused in the Salem witch trials. Quoted, Trump wrote to Pelosi. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's their cover in order to say, well, we just
he
did say that. This isn't an untrue headline. It's just they didn't tell the story.
Yeah. Okay.
That's where their cover will be.
Exactly, and it's not acceptable. Okay, I have higher expectations, everyone should. That's why we do segments like this, is because I want you to have higher expectations than people have grown accustomed to. Axios, recently evaluated as $200 million it's worth. New, Trump has sent Nancy Pelosi a letter condemning Democrats' handling of impeachment, stating more due process was afforded to those accused of the Salem witch trials. Yeah, technically, I guess, is that the most important thing that was going on? Goes on, let's see, Washington Post. Trump excoriates Pelosi and Democrats in letter to House Speaker, says impeachment is declaring open war on American democracy. It's not, it's constitutional. One could argue it's their duty, their obligation. And all across the country, Republicans are trying to make our democracy, like at best, sort of a technicality that they don't need to abide by and get as many people to not be able to vote as possible. Like, put this in the context of what's actually going on in regards to the future of American democracy. That's the Washington Post. They have like 10,000 reporters, and that's the best they could do.
I'm telling you this again, all they did was quote him and it said, hey, we just said what he said. You can take it for what you want. It's now a Mark Zuckerberg version where they say, hey, I'm just gonna put it out there and let you decide whether or not it makes any sense. And
yeah.
Number two, after this many years of this president beating down on the media, telling them they're fair, they're unfair, they're false, they're fake, they're messing with me, they're doing this, unprecedented, never happens again. Eventually, the goalposts get shifted enough where they go, we look unfair to people, even though we know we have been fair. So let's go ahead and try and look as fair as possible.
Yeah.
This is the conclusion of that offensive.
Of like decades of attacking the media to be more favorable to the right.
And then fairness has become more favorable to someone who's completely lying in your face
yeah.
every day. We're being fair, we're telling you what he said.
Yeah, yeah, you figure it out. It can't be hard. I mean, everybody's doing the exact same thing we are. There's no actual information going out there. So a second ago, I said that that's the best that we can expect out of the Washington Post, but it's not the worst we can expect because they also have this. Headline, Trump appears resilient as he faces the very ugly word of impeachment.
Quote, very ugly word.
Yeah.
They didn't say it, he did.
Democracy dies in darkness. Now here's some darkness for you, America. Let's see what you do with that. So it's the Washington Post and their goal, the night before impeachment, when he sends this crazy, whiny, conspiracy theory written letter is to say, he appears resilient, he's strong, okay? And it's a wonder that no Trump supporters are turning on him. They all seem to think that he's actually doing very well in this. Weird.
Well, to Trump supporters, he seems resilient.
Yeah, he does seem resilient. If you read these headlines, he seems resilient. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, a guest's gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We know that gun violence is really bad in America, obviously, but there's a lot that we don't know about it, in part because a lot of studies that hypothetically could have happened did not, because the federal government was effectively blocked from conducting that sort of research, but perhaps not in the future. And joining us now to break down this potentially momentous change, Jonathan Metzl, professor and director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University and the author of Dying of Whiteness. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, it's great to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, and for good news, which is pretty rare. So tell me, before we get to the new legislation that we're gonna talk about, tell me about why these studies haven't been done in the past, and what effect do you think that that lack of research might have had?
It's kind of an unimaginable situation that we've had in this country for the past, you know, more than two decades. In the mid-1990s, there were a series of studies in leading medical journals that basically showed that having a gun in the home was a risk factor for having a shooting in the home. It's hard to imagine how that wouldn't be the case otherwise, but two big studies, one found that having a gun in the house increased the chance of a domestic shooting, another found that having a gun in the house increased the chance of a suicide in the house, a gun suicide. And the NRA and its supporters basically took this as an opportunity to say there's an anti-gun bias in public health research, which wasn't the case. They were actually showing real statistical correlations. And they used that to add a rider to the federal budget in 1996 called the Dickey Amendment, which effectively blocked the federal government from using the kinds of funds it normally uses to study, you know, cancer or tuberculosis or car accidents. It basically blocked that kind of funding from going to gun research. And what we've seen is about a 2.5 decade ban on those kind of research studies. And so effectively, these large scale studies that would ask important questions, you know, what are the best gun safety procedures? What are the best state level policies? What kind of, what kind of storage practices are the safest that we should be knowing, because we live in a country where there are an awful lot of guns. But those big studies haven't been done. And really, I think what we're seeing now is hopefully that dam starting to break with the outline of the new congressional budget.
And it is really amazing. Like, tens of thousands of Americans, at least every year, die due to guns. And the government is
almost
40,000. And they're banned effectively from finding out how that might be helped. Like, this is an obvious threat to the American people. And due to that rider, they can't look into it. Really fast, though. So from the research that we did, it appears that it doesn't explicitly bar the research, but it did effectively stop it. Why then, even with, you know, for instance, Democratic presidents, have they not been able to get around what isn't an explicit ban?
Well, the resilience of this particular issue, of course, because when you pass a budget, you need a lot of people to sign off on it. And it's been kind of a non-starter for budgets really since the mid-1990s.
Yeah.
And so every time, even, you know, they renewed the Dickey Amendment effectively. And in fact, it expanded every couple of years. They did it, you know, 2 weeks after the Charleston shooting. They did it, it's just been part of the federal budget process. And it's basically been a non-starter from the Republican side that has effectively blocked the budget process. And the effects, as you suggest, are really incredible. If you look at, for example, if you just correlate the deaths by a certain pathogen versus the amount of money that we study it, gun violence was at the very bottom. I think it was linked with next to like leprosy or something in terms of just the amount of money we put into that. But as you say, gun deaths have been rising. So it's kind of, every time there's a mass shooting, we ask, well, how can we stop mass shootings? And the honest answer is we don't know, because we don't have the research. So it's had a profound effect on research. It's had a profound effect on publications. It's had a profound effect on just the careers that leading researchers go into. And so, again, what we're seeing now is, I think, not just the Democrats pushing, but what's important now is that I think the Republican side is willing to admit that there's so much frustration about this issue that at least the indication we have so far is that the Senate and the president will sign off on this budget, which would be a big symbolic change.
So, Jonathan, it's JR. So, we talk about the misinformation that they've been pushing this since the 1996 over this, just to not even get the studies to know the information on it. And this is obviously nothing new. So I want to compare it to the way that we're doing with climate change. There's information about climate change, but there's still not much legislation on a broad scale to actually do something about it. So I guess I'm the pessimist here. So I love that there's going to be this studies and the information is going to be out there. But how is that going to correlate to them switching over to allowing lawmakers to actually do something about it when it comes to law? Like, we have plenty of information. And once we have it concrete in our face, we'll just say, information's there. Now we won't do anything about it. What's going to make that switch on this?
Well, that's really the vital question here. In other words, what's being promised, at least in this congressional budget, is $25 million, which is definitely a lot in terms of, somebody's life, but in terms of what it costs to actually study a problem, we put billions of dollars toward, smoking and HIV and things like that. So it's not a ton of money. But I think the question is, how much money does it take to address the issue of having a gun around or having bad gun policies leads to more deaths? You could probably solve that with $25, yeah. You know, in a certain kind of way. And so the question is going to be, once if we find out what policies work best, is there the will to implement right. those policies? And so yeah. research, you know, I think what research does is it gives validity to arguments, right? It gives validity to basically saying there's science behind this. But as we see with climate change, it's a perfect example. This is not the age of where we value expertise. It's yeah. easy to discredit expertise. And so the real question will be, does that research lead to better policies? And particularly in this case, does that research lead to federal policies, right? Because the problem with gun policy is, you know, I'm in New York today. New York has great gun policies for the most part, relatively low rates of gun injury and death. Tennessee, where I live, it's the opposite. And so it's really, you know, are we willing to take policies that work and implement them in really in pro-gun red states where there are a lot of guns around? I think that would be the big question.
Yeah.
One last question for you. So we've apparently got the funding, or at least it seems likely that it'll be signed. And credit to Representative DeLauro for working on that. But I guess it's just a question of prediction. The money is going to be allocated, but Donald Trump is still president. Do you think that it is likely that it will actually be used in the way that it's intended?
Well, this money is earmarked, again, $25 million for the CDC and the NIH. Who knows? Prediction is we're not doing great with prediction right now. I would say that, you know, there's a huge budget. There's also, you know, money for, you know, raising the vaping age and other kinds of things. So there are plenty of kind of social red flags here. You know, it'll depend. I think that the balance is, on one hand, $25 million to the CDC and NIH. It's a symbolic victory, but it won't dramatically change the research landscape. And as this is happening, there's a whole other issue going on, which is that a lot of gun policy is being dictated in the Supreme Court and in the judiciary. And so I would bet, if I had to guess, that this budget gets signed, just because there are so many other kind of pro-gun victories happening at the judiciary level, not at the research level right now, that I think that ultimately, if people were saying, oh, this means the NRA is weak, and I don't read it that way. I think that the NRA is very strong in the courts, which I think is a very important issue, because ultimately that's where we're going to dictate whether or not these policies are brought into the real world.
Okay, well, we certainly appreciate you joining us on the show. Jonathan Metzl, author and professor at Vanderbilt University. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime, thanks so much.
We're gonna take a short break here, stick around. Today is impeachment day, but as of us recording this, he has not yet been impeached. But it seems almost certainly like it's going to happen. So I wanted to give you our reactions, assuming that it does. But before JR and I talk about what we think about this momentous day, I want to get a reaction from someone who's really wrapped up in this thing. That would be Donald Trump, who just tweeted a little bit ago, "Such atrocious lies by the radical left, do nothing Democrats. This is an assault on America and an assault on the Republican Party." If it seems like I was screaming, that's because that entire tweet was in all caps. But he doesn't mind. He really doesn't mind impeachment.
Again, he's connected. It's the entire Republican Party and Donald Trump. No, it's just you. But the entire Republican Party has jumped on board. He thinks, when he says, "I talk about America. When I said that call, I said, do us a favor." No, it was just you. He keeps connecting himself as if that's how a dictator works.
Yeah.
This country is mine. Everything that I want is what the country wants.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it seems like it's going to happen. I mean, there's 233 Democrats. Only two of them have announced that they oppose impeachment. One is Jeff Van Drew, who we might be talking about a little bit later. The other is Colin Peterson. There's also Jared Golden, a representative from Maine, who says he plans to vote for the first impeachment article on abuse of power, but against the second on obstruction of Congress, which is an interesting decision that seems sure to anger everyone in the entire country. So, interesting choice. I'm curious to find out his reasoning for
right.
that. No Republicans have committed to support impeachment unless you count Justin Amash, who left the Republican Party earlier this year and will soon leave elected government because there's no way Republicans are going to support him. And that is really something. I mean, there's still a couple of hundred of them almost, and not one Not one thinks that what he did is unacceptable. But every one of them, if Obama had done the exact same thing, would be calling for his head.
That's how a strong man works. You know, you scare everyone, and then, especially when you have the kind of base that's as rabid as his is, it pumps everyone, it pumps fear into everyone. So while we've seen the flip, how many Republicans liked this guy when he started running?
Duncan Hunter, that's about it. Maybe
Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions, really, yeah. That's about it.
And now they all flip because they're afraid of
him. They will go down in history as doing whatever they can to protect him. So look, it's probably gonna happen. And I know, everybody, like everybody on the right is saying he wants this, this is gonna help him, this is gonna get him reelected in 2020. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're right. Even some people more in the center think, oh, really risky. Pelosi was really worried about that. I will leave you with one thing. This is a quote we've read before, but if you wanna get into to what Trump actually thinks about this, when he says he likes the impeachment, he wants it to drag out, just remember what he said when he called in a Fox and Friends back in 2014. He said, do you think Obama seriously wants to be impeached? He would be a mess. He would be thinking about nothing but. It would be a horror show for him. It would be an absolute embarrassment. It would go down in his record permanently.
Ugh.
That was Trump.
Nothing else needs to be said. That's exactly how he feels.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll leave it there. We're gonna come back with more after this. A few weeks back, Pete Buttigieg was experiencing a lot of pressure to be a little bit more forthcoming about the way he was raising money for his presidential bid. People wanted the media to be able to go to his fundraisers. They wanted his bundlers, the people who've raised a lot of money for him, to be made public. And finally, after all of that pressure, he said, yes, I will let the media into my fundraisers, and here are my bundlers. And he gave them out. And it was an interesting list. But it was shorter than it should have been, because it turns out that he omitted about 20 high profile bundlers, and only now we're finding out who they were. They include uber wealthy supporters such as Boston power broker Jack Connors Jr., who declared he was, quote, all in for Pete Buttigieg in a June fundraiser invite, and Hollywood producer Jordan Horowitz, whose films include La La Land, which I quite enjoyed. Buttigieg also omitted hedge fund investor John Petrie, William Rahm, senior managing director at the private equity firm Centerbridge Partners, Nicole Levant, the former US ambassador to the Bahamas, and former US ambassador to Italy, John Phillips. The latter two were also major Obama donors. And we do know one of his recent fundraisers, the partners or spouses of a number of Silicon Valley tech CEOs have also become big fans of Pete Buttigieg. So we are learning more. But it's a slow process, and they're not making it any easier than it has to be.
I remember when he was gonna start becoming more transparent after he said he was gonna be the most transparent candidate. And then he was forced to become more transparent with the background and the business issues and all the things with donors. And as soon as it happened, and again, as I mentioned during our interview with Jonathan Metzl, I said, I'm the pessimist here. I was like, there's gonna be a way that he's not gonna tell us everything. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's a politician. Of course, he's not gonna tell us everything. So this is just the beginning of that becoming exposed. And by the way, hey, he's been so blatant with saying, yeah, no, I'm not gonna go that way. Yeah, no, it's whatever, I'm gonna find on that. And yeah, blowing people off at events, just say it, bro. Just say, no, I don't care. I'm gonna show you all of my donors. At least you'll be honest, and yeah, maybe you'll keep a certain level of people who believe in your honesty, because it's gonna come out anyway.
Yeah, yeah. The argument about why they were left off up until today is a little bit odd too. In a statement, the campaign said it had made an error and would update its public list of campaign bundlers to include an accurate accounting. They said the error happened as it tallied the total amount of money the bundlers has raised. So the idea there is, if they didn't believe that these people had passed the threshold to be considered a bundler, then they wouldn't appear on a list like this, which sort of makes sense. But some people who had previously disclosed in a document to donors were not listed on the disclosure Friday. So they had been listed on things that were going to potential donors to say, hey, look at these people who support me, but not to the press who are trying to find out who it is.
Exactly. Somehow you can recognize them for reasons that'll help you, but you won't recognize them for reasons that won't help. It's like a bill collector. If they call you and then they'll be like, hey, you owe us $75.27. You're like, man, you have it down to the penny. But if they owe you money, yeah, there's always something wrong with them giving you your money back. That's all, it's a hang up, it takes a while, but they want it immediately. When it comes to the positive side, they're good.
Yeah.
When it comes to anything where they have to give something up, I don't know, I can't figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, we've been talking a lot about Buttigieg recently, and it's partially because he raised a ton of money in Q3, and he suddenly blew up in the polls, and Like, we've been through a number of these elections. When someone who was not well known nationally doesn't have much of a record, like from their past elections to run on, and there's no proposals they're making that you can plausibly say, this is why people are going crazy for them. It's like, I'll give you less than Medicare for all. I'll do something about climate change, but less. Why are all of these Obama donors suddenly flocking to him? It makes you wonder what is filling up that gap. And for people who are really worried about the corrosive effect of money in politics, I start to wonder what promises are being made. And so I want as much information as possible. And so reporters, please stay on this campaign because that transparency is slow in coming.
So it's like being stuck in the middle of trying to still have the old establishment approach while also trying to look like a new kind of young, youthful energy into the party and into the presidential election.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we're gonna end this block just a little bit early, but stick around because in just a little bit, we're gonna have some of Lisa Page's appearance on Rachel Maddow last night. We'll have that for you after this. Former FBI lawyer Lisa Page is now doing media appearances about the fact that she's become a regular talking point on the right over the past few years. Here's a section of her from yesterday's Rachel Maddow explaining why it is that she finally decided to come out and speak.
Honestly, I just wasn't planning to and I didn't want to. I've led an entirely anonymous life and hoped to return to one. And when the president, you know, finally did that vile sort of simulated sex act in a, you know, rally in Minneapolis, I just finally had to accept it's not getting better. And being quiet isn't making this go away. And it wasn't working for me anymore.
If this doesn't slow down the president attacking you, is it still the right thing to do?
I mean, it's hasn't changed, so I don't see why I would continue doing the same thing.
Yeah.
At least I have my voice out there. At least if you want to respond, respond to me instead of this caricature that you've drawn up about me.
Yeah, and it is kind of amazing that like he and like Sean Hannity and all, they were talking about her like on a nightly basis for a year and a half and she never said anything. That's gotta be difficult.
Isn't that weird? But then the president tweets things like presidential harassment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The irony, it has no bounds. And consistently with, again, as you mentioned, the rally must have been the last final straw of it all. But yeah, it doesn't do you any good to sit back and be quiet, but I also get reasons why you may want to. I'm maybe one of those people that would actually advise someone to just chill and maybe it'll blow over, but obviously it hasn't.
Yeah, no, definitely not. But she alluded to the trigger for her coming out and saying something. For those of you who aren't familiar with American politics, this is a thing that happened.
I love you, Peter. I love you too, Lisa. Lisa, I love you. Lisa, Lisa. Oh God, I love you, Lisa. And if she doesn't win, Lisa, we've got an insurance policy, Lisa. We'll get that son of a bitch out.
It's the president of the United States pretending to. Best case scenario, it's not a simulated orgasm, but it's definitely simulated sex in front of a crowd of thousands, and they love it.
Because that's how you can connect with people.
Can I say one thing? Yeah. So about a month ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, I formally endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders for president. If he pretends to have sex on stage, I'm done. Just as a general rule, not supporting a politician that pretends to have an orgasm in public, not interested in it, okay? So anyway, that happened.
We've talked before, and I think it was, you guys know Brett from Young Turks, and we were talking before about if Trump is actually funny was yesterday. He was like, yeah, I mean, the people think it's funny, you know, he's not just not funny. I said, but the thing is the way people were falling back, head thrown back, laughter, it just wasn't funny. What's the clever part of that? Where's the punchline?
I don't know. The knee-jerk thing to say it is, if you believe that all of life should be a reality show, watching something like this, you react in the same way that like, insert name from, you know, the Jersey Shore is doing something crazy, like, this is reality though. So it kind of matters. Now the reason, of course, he alludes to it a little bit there, that she became this big talking point on the right was the text messages that the Inspector General report just came back and said there was no bias that led to the investigation. There were problems, but no bias. So here she is talking about the initial release of those text messages to the press.
It's really one of the more painful aspects of this entire 2 years. I mean, the president's attacks and assaults are one thing, but this is my institution. This is my Justice Department betraying us. And, you know, there's an element of, this is a claim that, well, this is congressional oversight and we had to do it. I have been a part of both of these institutions for a long time, and I know what it looks like when you're trying to, when the department is trying to protect people and protect information, and I know what it looks like when they're not. There were plenty of ways to fulfill their congressionally mandated oversight responsibility without politicizing our messages, without shoveling them out in the way that they did.
Why do you think they did it?
Well, my speculation is because this was not a great time for the Justice Department. You had Attorney General Sessions constantly beleaguered and being lambasted by the president for failing to sufficiently protect him. You had Rod Rosenstein going to the Hill early the next morning. I think it served a useful foil.
That's an interesting argument. I mean, look, he was being attacked on a daily basis, Jeff Sessions. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that argument?
It makes sense, but that's again, that's another part of it. The only way for a president to act like this and to get away with the number of things he does, he needs a lot of help. Mm-hmm. And again, this is one of those ways that's helped the Department of Justice. He's supposed to be the lead law man of the country. The head of the Department of Justice works for the president to help him get away from consequences and to help him destroy the character of other people that are working within that Department of Justice. If you wrote it down and said this would happen, people go, there's no way. You guys have too many protections behind this. You guys have too many people that are principled. You have too many people that would actually stand up and go, hey, you guys, what are we doing this for?
Yeah.
And where will this lead? But we're not those people anymore.
Yeah.
That's what we've become. And if someone points that out, they're un-American, not the people who are doing un-American actions.
Yeah.
It's flipped it completely on its head.
It's so weird. Like, I feel like I need to like state this because you hear the name Lisa Page and you think, oh, it's wrapped up in that whole thing. It's about Trump and it's about Russia and all that stuff. But like, remember, at the end of the day, the only reason you have any connotations to that name whatsoever is because Donald Trump became obsessed with her. And like think about like if Obama had found out about this lawyer at the EPA, Greta Johnson, and started tweeting about her every day. And Rachel Maddow was talking about Greta Johnson and the EPA, this lawyer, how dare she? And then like there's books written about Greta Johnson in the EP. It'd be so weird. Lisa Page didn't work for Hillary Clinton. She's just a lawyer at the FBI. There's a lot of them. I can't tell you how many. Maybe there's 50, maybe there's 1,000, maybe there's 5,000. I don't know, but it's a pretty common thing. She just happened to be one of them. And to get the pressure off the president, they made her a national figure. And so, look, I don't know what she's like. I don't know what her politics are like. She seems to not like Trump, so she's at least a rational person. Mm-hmm. But it's just crazy that she became the victim of this campaign. And as a general thing, like we're gonna move on from Lisa Page. She's not a national figure, but there's always gonna be Lisa Page. Sometimes it's Hillary Clinton, the right obsesses for years. Then there's Lisa Page. For a while, there's Elizabeth Warren. There's always gonna be a woman who is the target of their ire. So just buckle up. That's the rest of your life, Lisa Page, until the day we die.
And sadly, because she's a woman, and then she's become the ire of it, then you get to connect something sexual to her because that's the way Neanderthal type of men like him think. They're like, oh, if I can just have everyone's head and mind go to simulated sex acts of her, then it'll be okay. Because guess who isn't going in people's minds? Peter Strzok.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're not contemplating him naked and then thinking about that.
I wasn't. thank you. And the thing, like, let's say Trump was right. The whole right was right. That she was biased. That she only investigated him because she hated him. She wanted to overthrow his presidency. What does her sex life have to do with any of that? Has nothing to do with that. In fact, the presence of your conversation about her sex life implies that the rest of it doesn't exist, that you need something to talk about, so that's why you're talking about that.
But are we talking about Trump's multiple accusations of sexual violence on women?
We should be.
How he raped his wife. Are we talking about that stuff every day? And is someone as high as the president coming on and saying, hey, remember that? And reading it in a dramatic form? No.
No.
Sorry.
Okay, we only have a little bit more time, but I did want to read. There's been some great reviews on iTunes for the podcast, including a little bit of funny stuff. So, Samir Campaign 84 said, awesomely devastating. John has great co-hosts. informative guests, and a tenacious commitment to truth that is hard to come by on many platforms. He is one of the best radio hosts around, with a smiley face. So I appreciate that as an inside joke a little bit. But Forklift Cowboy says, Golden Globe nominee to be, if you like HBO's Watchmen, then you'll love The Damage Report. Oh. I don't know, I guess. And let's see. Gina says, I normally watch The Damage Report on the TYT app the following morning when I get ready for work. There are interesting and unique interviews with various candidates, activists that are insightful and help me learn about what else is going on in the country. John regularly has guest hosts like Brooke Thomas, J.R. Jackson, and Brett Ehrlich to discuss the news in an impactful way that doesn't make me feel overwhelmed by it at all. I highly recommend The Damage Report for anyone who wants to ease into politics or even just get hoping to get a progressive perspective on the news. So thank you for that. Everybody, please review the podcast. We really appreciate that. Thank you, JR. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.